tried to remember, and I'm going to quiz you a little bit tonight, passages that we want to use in our efforts to teach those who are not Christians, and some of the things that we are learning, of course, are helpful to us as we establish the very fundamental principles of divine authority. Now, I had a teacher, or several teachers, as I was growing up, who would every once in a while say, close your books and get out a sheet of paper. And I remember the sick feeling in the pit of my stomach when he would say that. But sometimes that's necessary because it challenges our thinking right on the spot. I've often said, as we have reviewed passages, that if we could just take the class to an opportunity, we wouldn't forget anything. But we don't have the class at every opportunity. So it's necessary that we commit some things to mind, that we can recall them on occasion when we need them. So technically speaking, close your books and you can leave the sheet of paper put away and you won't need a pencil, but I'm just going to ask you. When we read of the children of Israel coming up out of the land of Egypt as Moses was leading them, of course they're promised a particular land because God had spoken unto their fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and promised them the land from the river of Egypt to the river Euphrates. When we look at the promise that was initially made to Abraham, where do I turn? What passage, Ken? Okay. You're all over it. You're all over it. Yeah, can you help him out there, Karen? 12. God made three promises to Abraham. What were they? Land, nation, and seed promise. That's right. And when he promised to give unto Abraham a certain land, how long would it be before he would get it, Jenny? When Abraham got to that land, he found there were other folks living there. Yeah, he traveled about 1,000 miles to get there. Yeah, so it took quite a little while, but it's going to be how long now before it's his land? See, when he came, he was a stranger and a sojourner. And it's going to be quite some time. All right, 400 years. It would be four generations. We learned in the New Testament it would be 430 years before it would be his. Now, as we look at that, that's all of Genesis chapter 12. 1, 2, and 3, and then the fourth generation element is in Genesis chapter 15. Now, I want you to remember these. When they began to grow and develop down in Egypt, of course, Joseph has preceded them into Egypt and has become second in command of all of Egypt and prepares for his family. There's 7 years of plenty, followed by 7 years of famine. And after 2 years of famine, Joseph's family has moved down into Egypt. And how many of them came down, Carolyn? You remember? About 70, thereabouts. And quite some time later, four generations, how many came out? All right, 600,000 fighting. Most scholars tell us when you factor in the old men, the women, the children, and so forth, we've got a crowd of folks, maybe 2 to 3 million people. Who was it to bring them out? Moses would bring them out. And when Moses began to bring them out, we learned that Moses told them that, move that up higher. How about that? Moses told them that when you come into the land, and you begin to worship idols, God's going to drive you out. And where do I read that? Deuteronomy chapter 4. It's a lot harder when we don't have our Bible in front of us opened up to those passages. Deuteronomy chapter 4, verses 24 and 25. And then Moses told them yet again, that when you worship idols, God's going to drive you out. Again in Deuteronomy. Whereabouts? Chris, you remember? We've got Deuteronomy 4. Okay, that's the verse, verse 24 and 25. And then we've got Deuteronomy chapter 8. Deuteronomy chapter 8. Now, I want you to be well familiar with these, because we're going to have occasion to do this again. Deuteronomy chapter 8. Those of you in our Acts class, maybe you remember how we went over and over and over, and you remember Acts, don't you? Okay. Deuteronomy chapter 8. Look, if you will, at verse 19. It says, "And it shall be that if thou shalt forget Jehovah thy God and walk after other gods and serve them and worship them, I testify against you this day that ye shall utterly perish as the nations that Jehovah maketh to perish before you, so shall ye perish because you would not hearken unto the voice of Jehovah your God." You wouldn't listen. And if you won't listen, God's going to destroy you. So we've got Deuteronomy 4, we've got Deuteronomy 8. Now we've got three chapters in Deuteronomy. We call it the blessings and the curses. Where are they? Deuteronomy 28 through 30. That's close. Deuteronomy 28 through 30. Now I want you to look at your Bible here, because this particular passage is very significant because of the wording. Now Deuteronomy 28, you'll notice the if you do this, then you'll be blessed in everything you put your hand into. Remember that context? And then in verse 15, if you don't do this, this, and this, then you'll be cursed in everything you put your hand into. You see the flip side of that equation. Now hold your Bible there at Deuteronomy chapter 30, in verse 1. "It shall come to pass when all these things are come upon thee, the blessing and the curse, which I have set before thee, and thou shalt call them to mind among all the nations, whether Jehovah thy God hath driven thee, and shalt return unto Jehovah thy God, and shalt obey his voice according to all that I command thee this day, thou and thy children with all thy heart and with all thy soul, that then Jehovah thy God will turn thy captivity." When you do this, God's going to do that. But what is it that they're going to do? He said, when you do these things and God drives you out, and then when you return, verse 2, you see that? When you return, then what's God going to do? He's going to turn your captivity. You're going to be brought back into the land. Now that's evidence that they at one time had it. You can't lose something you never had and then have that restored. And you'll see the condition of that in verse 10. Keeping the commandments and the statutes which are written in the book of the law. That's the law of Moses. And let me just really hammer this point home for just a moment. If you're ever talking with someone who is a premillennialist, who believes that some of these restoration promises are yet to be fulfilled, that the Jews are going to one day be returned to the land, you note this passage. Because Moses said, here's the condition upon which you'll return, and that is keeping the commandments, statutes, and ordinances contained in this book of the law. Do you see that? What is this book of the law? Law of Moses. Well, the New Testament just hammers that home. We're never going to be under that again. So you'd have to reinstate the law in order for that to happen. Now, during the days of the restoration of Nehemiah and Ezra and Zerubbabel and these characters, of course, that was done under the terms of these conditions. So the premillennial theory is a hoax, to say the least. Now, you'll remember that, right? Deuteronomy chapter 30, verses 1 through 10. Now, Moses told them that. Deuteronomy chapter 4, Deuteronomy chapter 8, Deuteronomy chapter 28 through 30. All right? That's what I want you to remember. Joshua told them that. Joshua was instructed he would be the one who would bring them into the promised land. Joshua chapter 1. And you remember in Joshua chapter 11, Joshua has brought them into the promised land. But in Joshua chapter 13 forward, we find the divisions of the land according to the tribes. And in Joshua chapter 21, verses 43 through 45, what do we learn? Joshua 21, 43 through 45. Jackie, can you help me out? Yes, ma'am. We learned that God gave them the land. They possessed the land. They dwelt in the land. And Joshua said, not one thing has failed of all the good things that Jehovah God said would come to pass. Now, that takes us to Joshua chapter 16. Write that in your list. Joshua chapter 16. No, that's not right. It's Joshua chapter 23, verse 16. Okay? What's it say in Joshua chapter 23, verse 16? Carolyn? All right. Everything's come to pass. If you begin back about verse 14, everything has come to pass. But if you worship other gods, what's he tell them, Jennifer? What's going to happen to you? Take it all away. You'll lose it. You'll lose every bit of it. Now, we see that Joshua brings them in. And what do? Joshua dies. And all that generation dies. And in Judges chapter 2, verse 10, what do we now have on the scene? Julie? It tells us when Joshua is dead and all that generation are gathered unto their fathers, there arose a new generation that knew not God, nor the mighty works which he wrought in Israel. Now, the book of Judges, we see a cycle that occurs through a rotation of about 15 judges, counting Abimelech. Okay? And what happens in that rotation? We've got them being faithful to God for a while, and then what happens? All right, they start following idols. And when they follow idols, what did God do? He punished them. How did he punish them? Oppression. That's right. He would raise up an oppressor who would infiltrate their land and move in just a bit, and then they would cry to God, and God would do what? Raise up a deliverer or a judge, and then they'd be faithful for a while. Now, with these 15 judges going around that horn, about how many years did they do that? A little over 300 years they did that. Round and round we go. Now, that's what the book of Judges is all about. Now, when you come to the end of the book of Judges, what's the condition in Israel? Last verse of the book. They did what was right in their own eyes. Now, when we began the book of 1 Samuel, skipping the book of Ruth, when we began the book of 1 Samuel, Samuel is the last of the judges. And what is it that they came to Samuel requesting? Ken? Want a king. Well, now, wait a minute. Let's go back, if we will. During the days of Moses, this is another passage you need in your list, in Deuteronomy chapter 17. Deuteronomy chapter 17, in verse 14. John, you mind to read some for me? 14 through 17, please. All right. He's not supposed to be rich, or not supposed to be selfish and gather riches, is he, for himself? And that's the problem here. But beginning at verse 18, it shall be when he sitteth upon the throne of his kingdom that he shall write him a copy of this law in a book out of that which is before the priest, the Levites, and it shall be with him. And he shall read therein all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear Jehovah his God, to keep all the words of this law and these statutes, to do them, that his heart be not lifted up. Oh, here's the problem. if he doesn't commit himself to learning the commandments of God and keeping the commandments of God, what's likely to happen to your king when you ask for a king? He'll be lifted up with pride. And when he's lifted up with pride, what always follows? We always get in trouble, don't we? And so it was. Well, as we turn the pages, and we begin to read some in 1 Samuel. In chapter 8 of 1 Samuel, the people came to Samuel the judge, and they said, "We want a king." Well, now, why do we want a king? All right. We want to be like everybody else. We want to be like the nations round about us, you see. And God told Samuel, he said, "That's all right, you give them a king. That's not what I want, but that's what they want, and they've not rejected you. They've rejected me as their king, so you accommodate them. You give them a king." And so it was. But as we continue to read, Samuel told them what a king would mean to them. What would it be, Ken, to have a king like everybody else? All right, yeah, but didn't that seem to bother them any? No. We still want one. We'll have a king. We'll be like everybody else. That's what everybody else is doing. And so that'll be just fine. Give us a king. So they had a king. And Saul was the king that God selected for them. Now, we've got to communicate that to Saul. So Samuel goes to the house of Kish. No, doesn't go to the house of Kish. Who's he go to? No, he doesn't go. Saul comes to him. That's right, chapter 9. He's introduced to Saul. Saul had a son. Yes, verse 2. Saul had a son. He had a son, Kish did, whose name was Saul. I'll read it correctly. A young man and goodly, and there was not among the children of Israel a goodlier person than he. From his shoulders and upward, he was higher than any of the people. So we've got somebody now that can impress everybody. We've got a good-looking man. We've got a man that's very strong. He's taller than everybody else. He's a king in his stately image before everyone. So his appearance is very kingly. And we note in the context of the ninth chapter that when Saul is about to be anointed, what is his attitude? He's very humble. Who am I? Why, after all, you see, I'm a Benjamite, verse 21, the smallest of the tribes, and my family is least of all the families of the tribe of Benjamin. So why do you talk to me about being a king? Why, I can't do that. And it would seem that others were of the same opinion, thinking that Saul was just not the kind of man really to lead them in battle. But when we come to the 10th chapter, we learn that Saul is anointed with the vial of oil as Samuel pours it upon him and appoints him to be king. But then it's necessary for him to be recognized by the people to be their king. And in the latter part of the 10th chapter, so they declare in verse 24, "Long live the king." Now, when we come to chapter 11, the Israelites haven't had a problem with some of the other nations during the time of Samuel up until now, but they do now have a problem. What's the problem? The Ammonites are being mean to them, yeah. And what is it that the Ammonites are willing to settle and make peace for? Gouging out your right eye. That's a small price to pay for peace, isn't it, Juan? Just gouge out your right eye and we'll get along. Well, when Saul found out about that, what was his reaction? Yeah, and why? What message was he sending? You need to show up. I'm going to do that to your oxen. That's exactly right. Well, did he get an army? He sure did. We noticed that a whole bunch of folks showed up. In fact, about how many was it? 30,000? Oh, 300,000. Ooh. And it tells us, verse 8, he numbered them in Bezek of the children of Israel were 300,000 and the men of Judah 30,000. That'd be about 330,000, wouldn't it? That's a pretty sizable army, isn't it? Well, now he's got somewhat of an army. Now, when we come into the 13th chapter, the Philistines present a problem to the Israelites. Oh, by the way, Saul was very victorious over the Ammonites, and the army of Israel praised him, and they thought now he's ready to be king, and anybody that doubts it, bring him forth and let's kill him, right? But now we've got the Philistines presenting a threat. And what does Saul do? See, Saul's capital is where? Gibeah. And the Philistines are gathering on Michmash, right, kind of next door to Gibeah. And what is it that Saul does? Saul's in Gilgal, yes, but his capital is in Gibeah. Yeah, supposed to wait for Samuel. All right, so he does. He gets in a lot of trouble. He forces himself, he says, to go ahead and offer the sacrifice. And Samuel came and he said, "You've done foolishly. I told you to wait. You didn't wait. And so you've done very foolishly." Well, as we look at the text, what was the consequence to be imposed upon Saul because he wouldn't wait? He lost the kingdom. That's right. Samuel told him in verse 13 that I would have established your kingdom forever, but because you've done this, then that's not going to be. I'm looking for a man after God's own heart. Now, that rings all kinds of bells to us, and we know who that is. We talked about that. That was young David, who was to be the next king. Indeed, a man after God's own heart. Well, didn't Saul kind of start out with humility and all of those good things? What's happened to him? He's become prideful, lifted up with arrogance. And if you'll notice in this chapter, by the way, in chapter 13, we find... No, that's not correct. It's chapter 14. In chapter 14, that Saul becomes very victorious. He kind of follows the lead of Jonathan. Jonathan and his armor bearer attacked the Philistines against their garrison and were very successful. And so the Israelite army then became excited by Jonathan's apparent success. And Saul rallied his men together and they fight against the Philistines and they are very victorious. They defeat the Moabites and the Ammonites and the Edomites and the kings of Zobah and the Philistines and, at least at this point, the Amalekites. Things appear to be good, do they not, during the reign of Saul up till this point, except chapter 13. But then we've got chapter 15, and that's where I want to talk with you tonight. Chapter 15. In chapter 15, Saul's humility has faded. In verse 1, it says, "And Samuel said unto Saul, Jehovah sent me to anoint thee to be king over his people, over Israel. Now therefore hearken thou unto the voice of the words of Jehovah. Thus saith Jehovah of hosts, I have marked that which Amalek did to Israel, how he set himself against him in the way when he came up out of Egypt. Now go and smite Amalek and utterly destroy all that they have and spare them not, but slay both man and woman, infant and suckling, ox and sheep, camel and ass." Now let's pause right there. John, anything difficult or complicated about the instructions of God to Saul? No. If it has the brand Amalekite on it, kill it. Isn't that simple? If it belongs to them, destroy it. Destroy everything about them. Now why? This was important. When we go back in the text, Exodus chapter 17, what's going on in the book of Exodus? They're exiting. Yes, Jenny. Be a little bit more detailed. They're exiting. All right, they're traveling to the promised land. But the Amalekites kind of present a problem. What did the Amalekites do? All right, they did. And what did God say He was going to do to the Amalekites? Going to wipe them out. Now, read for me the text there, Exodus chapter 17, verse 14. Richard, please. Uh-huh. Going to blot them out. Be gone. Destroy them all. Now Moses mentioned this in the book of Deuteronomy. In chapter 25, verse 17, remember what Amalek did unto thee by the way as ye came forth out of Egypt, how he met thee by the way and smote the hindmost of thee, all that were feeble behind thee, when thou was faint and weary, and he feared not God. Therefore it shall be, when Jehovah thy God hath given thee rest from all thine enemies round about in the land which Jehovah thy God giveth thee for an inheritance to possess it, that thou shalt blot out all the remembrance, or the remembrance rather, of Amalek from under heaven, thou shalt not forget. Don't forget to destroy Amalek. Destroy everything that they have. Now that was going to come swiftly. If you'll notice in Numbers chapter 24 and in verse 20. Now, whose job is it to do that, to carry that out? Saul. Saul, you're supposed to do that. You destroy Amalek. You destroy everything that they have. Why? Because they stood in the way of Israel when they were coming up out of the land of Egypt. And so I want them killed. I want all of them killed. Man, woman, infant, suckling, ox, sheep, camel, and ass. You kill everything. Now some might pause and ponder a question, well, why did God want to destroy everything? Even the women folks, kill even the children. Well, we note that this judgment was on a national level. God is not hating the children, that's not the point. He's destroying the nation of the Amalekites, period. Everything that pertained to them. Now, when we look in the text, what did Saul do in verse 7? Ken, let me pick on you some more. What'd Saul do? Did he do what God said? No. What did he do? All right. It says he smote the Amalekites from Havilah as thou goest unto Shur, that is before Egypt. But he took Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive, and utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. But Saul and the people spared Agag, and the best of the sheep, and of the oxen, and of the fatlings, and the lambs, and all that was good, and would not utterly destroy them, but everything that was vile and refuse, that they utterly destroyed. Now, Bruce, I know you can't talk, but was that what God said? No. You see, Bruce can answer pretty loud. No. That wasn't what God said. God said destroy everything about them. He didn't say bring back the king. He didn't say bring back the best of anything. He said destroy everything. Wasn't difficult, John, to understand it, was it? Now, in verse 10, it came to pass, or then came rather, the word of the Lord unto Samuel, saying, it repenteth me that I have set up Saul to be king. For he has turned back from following me and hath not performed my commandments. Who said that? God did. Saul did not do what I said. Period. Who'd he say it to? Samuel. Look, if you will, at verse 12. And Samuel rose early to meet Saul in the morning, and it was told Samuel, saying, Saul came to Carmel, and behold, he set up him or set him up a monument and turned and passed on and went down to Gilgal. And Samuel came to Saul, and Saul said unto him, Blessed be thou of Jehovah, I have performed the commandment of Jehovah. True or false? False. Who called him a liar? God had already called him a liar. Look further in the text. And Samuel saith, What meaneth then this bleating of the sheep in mine ears and the lowing of the oxen, which I hear? And thus the answer that Lynn gave, who called him a liar? Well, Samuel did, but the animals did. You see, there wouldn't be any sound of these animals if he did what God said. They'd all be dead. Why do I hear the noise of the animals? And look at what Saul said. Saul said, They have brought them from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep and of the oxen to sacrifice unto Jehovah thy God, and the rest we have utterly destroyed. Then Samuel said to Saul, "Stay, and I will tell thee what Jehovah has said to me this night." And he said unto him, "Say on." Now, Saul, you want to rethink this thing? Notice the play on the words. I find it fascinating. It's just so typical of the excuses that we offer. They have brought them from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best to sacrifice unto Jehovah. But the rest we have utterly destroyed. You ever want to separate yourself from the thing that's wrong? That's what Saul wants to do. See, they did that. Who's king? Saul is. Who's responsible? Saul is. Oh, yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, didn't have any choice. Yeah. Well, go ahead. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, that's kind of how we want it, isn't it? But Samuel said, "You just hold tight, and I'll tell you what God told me." Now, in verse 17, Samuel said, "Though thou wast little in thine own sight, wast thou not made head of the tribes of Israel? And Jehovah anointed thee king over Israel." When you were little in your own sight, how did Saul recognize himself when he was being considered to serve as king? "I'm a tiny little fellow, you see. I'm the least in my father's house." Now verse 18. "And Jehovah sent thee on a journey and said, Go and utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they be consumed. Wherefore then didst not obey the voice of Jehovah, but didst fly upon the spoil, and didst that which was evil in the sight of Jehovah. And Saul said unto Samuel, Yea, I have obeyed the voice of Jehovah, and have gone the way which Jehovah sent me, and have brought Agag, the king of Amalek, and have utterly destroyed the Amalekites." You really think in Saul's sight he did what God said? Or does he know he didn't? Okay. What? Says, "But the people took of the spoil, sheep and oxen, the chief of the devoted things, to sacrifice unto Jehovah thy God in Gilgal."
But every time he's making excuses, he's referring to God as Samuel, your God.
That's interesting. Well, he simply refers to him as God, "I have performed the commandment of Jehovah," in verse 13. But he does refer to him as thy God in reference to the sacrifices that the people desire to make. Yeah, that raises a curiosity, doesn't it? Yeah. Makes me wonder, though, when you look at Samuel's, or rather at Saul's, strong affirmation, "I have done what God said." What we want to note here is doing part of it don't work. Just doing part of it doesn't work. Yeah. "Oh, I'm going to kill him anyway." Yeah. Yeah. Well, Samuel raises an interesting question, though, doesn't he? "Hath Jehovah as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of Jehovah?" We're going to talk about that, Carolyn. Yeah, that's a novel thought, isn't it? He knows what pleases him. Julie? Yeah. Well, it doesn't tell us. But we know what Samuel did with him. Yeah. Yeah, we're going to really outdo really what God said. Yeah. And you know, sometimes our reasoning goes that way, and it God didn't ask for that.
When it comes to Agag, the way that I've been looking at it is that it doesn't seem like Saul considers him an Amalekite. It's one of those things where he's the king, so he's not the same as the people. Because he's very confident, yes, I destroyed all the people and I spared Agag.
Okay, all right. Yeah.
And you can kind of see the, you know, it is a good point that he said, you know, we're going to sacrifice this to the Lord your God. I think he made that up on the spot. And I think he did for a number of reasons, but, you know, when he says the Lord your God, he's kind of saying, well, I'm doing this all for you. Why are you doing this at the hard time?
Yeah. Well, there's an element in all of this that I think we need to hammer home. I use crude illustrations, I guess, in some ways, but it goes back to my background when I was growing up on the farm. When you used an axe to chop down a tree, you want the axe to do what you tell it to do. What happens if it kind of develops a will of its own? Well, you can cut your leg. Yeah. You can cut all kinds of stuff. Well, the point is, you think ever that Saul saw himself as an instrument in the hand of God for judgment upon the Amalekites because of what the Amalekites did to his people back over in Exodus? No. God said destroy them. That means destroy them. This idea of sacrificing, and I'm going to do it a little bit better, or I'm going to do it more significantly, or I'm going to honor the king a little more, or do what I'd like to have done to me. It's all beside the point. God just simply said, kill them. Period. End of story. Now, why not just kill them? Now, all of us who've had children, we've had this argument, brethren. Haven't we? I want you to do this. Well, you come back later and it's not done just exactly what you said. Some of it may be done. There may be some variations. There may have been. But I have an idea. Who asked you to have an idea? Now, do we deal with our children that way? I have an idea. I'd like it to be done this way. Do you have a reason for saying, I want this, when you direct a child to do something? Do you have to explain all the reasons? Do you have to have an argument every time you tell them to do this? Or do you have the right to expect it to be done just exactly like you said? No argument, just do it. I have a reason for that. When God said, I want the Amalekites destroyed, He had already, through Moses, said why. Saul just simply didn't do it. And it took Samuel to tell him, here's what God told me. You want to argue, you argue the case with God. But here's the question. Hath Jehovah as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of Jehovah? Why not just do what he said? John read it a few moments ago. There's not anything difficult about the instructions, are there? Would you have any trouble just doing that, Jenny? Or would you think, no, maybe there might be some variable in here somewhere. Well, squeamishness aside, God said, kill them. Now, there's not any problem understanding that, is there? Well, well, we might speculate on that, but I want to call your attention to the latter thing that Samuel asks him or points out to him. He said, behold, to obey, verse 22, is better than sacrifice, and to hearken than the fat of rams. You think if God wanted the sacrifice, he knew how to say it? Yep. He does. And why? Who did? Because thou hast rejected the word of Jehovah. Now, who's bearing the responsibility of all this? Saul did. He was king. It was his job to lead these people. He was the one that received the simple instruction, go kill them. And he was the one that brought back Agag, whether he wants to place that responsibility on the people or not. But if you'll read further in the text, in verse 23, Samuel says, he hath also rejected thee from being king. Why? What kind of man needed to be king? A man after God's own heart. Saul started out that way, but he didn't stay that way. Now, there's a valuable lesson in that. We might start out with all humility, and then after a few successes, we begin to attribute all of our successes to how tall I am and my good looks and comely manner as a king and so forth. And now look at what I've done. And now when I get in trouble, you see, it wasn't me that did it, it's all you. We just want to point the finger of blame, and it becomes a blame game. Now, do you do that? When you get caught doing something that you shouldn't be doing, or not doing something you know you really should have done, and if you really examine yourself, you say, well, I really did mess up, but we've got to rationalize it and figure out how it really wasn't our fault. You ever do that? Who said that?
Your wife said that.
You said what, Richard? I just wanted a witness. But yeah, that's what we do, don't it? It turns into, who am I going to blame for this? Well, Saul, you're king, and it's your responsibility. You messed up. Now look, if you will, at verse 24. And Saul said unto Samuel, I have sinned, for I have transgressed the commandment of Jehovah and thy words, because I feared the people and obeyed their voice. Now therefore, I pray thee, pardon my sin, and turn again with me, that I may worship Jehovah. And Samuel said unto Saul, I will not return with thee, for thou hast rejected the word of Jehovah, and Jehovah hath rejected thee from being king over Israel. Two or three things we want to talk about, but first I want you to note that Saul, as we say in Kentucky, shelled down the corn. He pulled the shucks back where you could see the corn, and then he shelled down the corn. The idea is he laid bare his heart. Here's what I did. Now, I want to ask you a question. Does that make it all right? You know, Ken, I really didn't aim to. It's the people that did it. I'm sorry I did it. And therefore, everything's fine, right? Oh, you mean I have to pay the money back? Well, you see, it wasn't fine with Saul. He had rejected God. He had rejected the commandment of God. He had rejected Samuel as the leader that God had given to them. And consequently saying, I'm sorry, didn't fix it. And you know, sometimes that comes as a very rude awakening, doesn't it? We think no matter what we've done, we can say, I'm sorry. And that makes it all go away, don't it? No. And it's not just politics.
I mean, but, trying to say, oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Now I want to be back.
Yeah. We do that in all kinds of offenses, don't we? I'm sorry. But, you know, I'm sorry. Sorry don't always fix it. It just don't always fix it. There are consequences. And what happened to Saul because of what he did? He was rejected from being king. I want you to look at Samuel. Saul said to Samuel, just go back with me. You know, it would be what an honor for the prophet of God to accompany me back. Go back with me. What'd Samuel say? No, I'm not going to go back with you. You know why? Because you've rejected God. And God's rejected you. Look at verse 27. And as Samuel turned about to go away, Saul laid hold upon the skirt of his robe, and it rent. Now what's happened? Saul trying to force him. I want you to go, and he tears his clothes. And then in verse 28, Samuel said unto him, Jehovah hath rent the kingdom of Israel from thee this day, and hath given it to a neighbor of thine that is better than thou. Take that. There's somebody better than you, Saul. There's somebody that'll do what God said. John? Yeah. Losing face. Yeah. In verse 29, and also the strength of Israel will not lie nor repent, for he is not a man that he should repent. And he said, I have sinned, yet honor me now, I pray thee, before the elders of my people and before Israel, and turn again with me, that I may worship Jehovah thy God. There's your point again. He says, so Samuel turned again after Saul, and Saul worshiped Jehovah. Did Samuel go back with him? Eventually, he relented and went back with him. But, in verse 32, Samuel then said, bring ye hither to me Agag, the king of the Amalekites. Now, you'll like this. And Agag came unto him cheerfully. And Agag said, surely the bitterness of sin, or the bitterness rather of death, is past. What's Agag's attitude? Let's just let bygones be gone. Wonderful day. Oh, perhaps not. Cheerfully. Yeah, he returned cheerfully. And Samuel said, as thy sword hath made women childless, so shall thy mother be childless among women. And Samuel hewed Agag in pieces before Jehovah in Gilgal. What did Samuel do to him? He chopped him up. You think Agag's arrogant attitude that everything's great now, not going to be any more killing going on. Didn't turn out quite that way, did it? Agag was killed. Samuel chopped him up. And you'll note in verse 34, Samuel went to Ramah, and Saul went up to his house, to Gibeah, of Saul. And Samuel came no more to see Saul unto the day of his death. For Samuel mourned for Saul, and Jehovah repented that he had made Saul king over Israel. Now, when Samuel said, I'm not going to go with you anymore, he did go back to worship. But he didn't go anymore with Saul. His running around days with Saul were over, weren't they? Why? Saul had rejected the Word of God. And Samuel didn't honor that. Ever. That's the way it is. Okay, we'll stop with that. Lots more to say about this. Study carefully onward in 1 Samuel chapter 16 and forward. By the way, while you're studying, I want you to look on your maps at the places that David went when he was fleeing from Saul. Make note of those places, okay? We'll have occasion to talk about that.